Welcome to CHOATS Enforcement and Investigations Updates, a podcast series hosted by our Government Enforcement and Compliance Group. On this show, we discuss timely analysis of legal and compliance developments, court decisions, and changes in legislation and regulations related to white-collar defense, global investigations, and whistleblower claims.
Hi, and welcome to all of our listeners. I'm Kristen Perriello, a principal in the Government Enforcement Group here at CHOATE. With me today is Emily Hodge, a partner in the Government Enforcement Group. As you are no doubt aware, recently there have been a number of significant False Claims Act cases and decisions. Today, we will focus our discussion on a few legal and practical takeaways arising from the Supreme Court's decision in the SuperValu case and the string of differing decisions in the circuit courts relating to the causation element in False Claims Act cases premised on anti-kickback statute violations. Emily, the SuperValu decision, while narrow, certainly has implications for companies operating in complex, highly regulated industries. But before we dive into those, could you start by just providing a quick overview of the case for those who may be unfamiliar with it?
Sure. Thanks, Kristen. So for those unfamiliar with the SuperValu decision, the case in essence involves two retail pharmacies' interpretations of the term usual customary prices, which is the price the companies were required to charge Medicaid and Medicare. In both instances, the companies knew that their discounted prices were the usual and customary prices, yet they instead reported the higher non-discounted prices. At issue when the case reached the Supreme Court was what constituted scienter. The Supreme Court held that the False Claims Act scienter element refers to the defendant's knowledge and subjective beliefs at the time the claims are submitted, and not what an objectively reasonable person would have known or believed at that time. A key aspect of this decision was, as mentioned, evidence that the companies in both cases understood the relevant regulatory standard, yet submitted inaccurate claims anyway.
Right. So to that point, the Supreme Court's decision was fairly narrow in that it only addressed situations where a business knows its interpretation is wrong at the time they submit a claim. And in that situation, the Supreme Court made clear that a company cannot rely on the fact that others may have reasonably interpreted the statute in a way that complies with the regulatory requirements. But what are some of the scenarios that the decision does not reach?
Yeah, so there are a couple scenarios the decision does not reach. So first, those where a defendant honestly believed it was interpreting a regulation correctly and submitted a claim based on an objectively reasonable interpretation of the law that later turns out to be wrong. Another one is instances where a defendant subjectively believes its claims are false, but they turn out not to be false as a matter of law. So that's a situation where there is scienter, but no falsity, and therefore no liability in those situations. And as we discussed, the decision is also focused just on scienter. It does not impact the analysis of the falsity or materiality elements of False Claims Act claims. It is also important to note that this is a case with bad facts. There's evidence that exists to demonstrate that the companies clearly knew their interpretation of the regulation was incorrect and had even taken steps to conceal their conduct from the government.
Right. And so, Emily, what are some of the key takeaways and potential implications for companies resulting from this decision?
So the decision makes clear that a defendant's subjective belief is critical to the scienter element. While the scienter element prior to this case often made it difficult to obtain dismissals at the motion to dismiss or summary judgment phase, this decision likely makes that even harder. The company's intent is an inherently factual determination, and now there will be even more focus on what the company knew at the time it submitted a claim. Another potential implication is the fact that the decision seems to suggest that companies faced with an ambiguous regulation and a scenario where there's a, quote, significant risk that their interpretation is incorrect may have a duty to inquire with the relevant government stakeholders. Now, this does not account for the reality of the way in which most of these situations play out, which is that there often is not a quick or straightforward avenue for companies to obtain that kind of guidance from the government. If companies make such a request but have to act before they obtain guidance, will the fact that they believed such clarification was necessary be used against them if they submit a claim based on that belief? I think that's something we have yet to see the answer to. Given the court's focus on subjective intent, companies should consider whether contemporaneous documentation of the decision-making process is needed or warranted. The decision does not address what evidence would establish an unjustifiably high risk that the defendant's interpretation of the regulation is incorrect. We can expect that this will be a very fact-intensive analysis that will vary in each case. So in terms of a bottom line takeaway, companies in highly regulated environments should continue to be diligent about understanding the relevant rules and regulations. They should seek guidance and obtain legal advice on unclear issues, should memorialize their good faith interpretations of ambiguous requirements in contemporaneous records, and consider seeking guidance from the relevant agencies, maybe even if the agency is unlikely to respond, on the relevant interpretation, whether that's through formal requests for guidance, through comments to proposed rules, or through other available processes. So, Kristen, another key issue currently being debated in the circuit courts is how to interpret the causation element in False Claims Act cases that are premised on anti-kickback statute violations. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it's currently playing out?
Sure. So as many of you know, in 2010, Congress amended the anti-kickback statute to add a provision that states that a claim resulting from, and that's the key language, a violation of the anti-kickback statute constitutes a false claim for purposes of the False Claims Act. In the years that have followed, courts have construed this resulting from language as essentially a causation element. But the question then becomes, what causation standard applies? So some courts, including those in the Sixth and Eighth Circuits, have adopted a but-for causation standard, meaning an HCP would not have prescribed a drug but for the kickback provided by the pharmaceutical manufacturer. Other courts, including those in the Second, Third, Fourth, and Fifth Circuits, have adopted a much more relaxed standard, which merely requires some link between the kickback and the claim. In those cases, the fact that a HCP would have prescribed the drug absent the kickback may be viewed as irrelevant. Based on the legislative history of the anti-kickback statute and other statutes, the defense bar has and continues to take the position that courts should clearly apply a but-for causation standard, arguing essentially that using any other standard will lead to unintended outcomes, is inconsistent with the statutory history, and also with the purposes of the False Claims Act.
Thanks, Kristen. So what is it that companies should be thinking about as a result of this current split in the case law?
Well, I think it remains to be seen whether the Supreme Court ultimately decides to resolve this issue. But in the meantime, and particularly in ongoing government investigations, companies should, of course, understand what standard applies in the relevant jurisdiction and be prepared to litigate the issue in those circuits with the less favorable some link standard. While this issue continues to evolve, interestingly, the government has already started pointing to the supervalue decision that we discussed earlier in the causation context. For example, in an anti-kickback case involving relationships with independent patient assistance programs in the First Circuit, the government recently argued that the supervalue decision demonstrates that courts should not rely strictly on the interpretation of a term from a separate statute. At issue in the pending case is the resulting from language of the anti-kickback statute. There, the government quoted from the supervalue decision to emphasize that courts should construe words in their specific statutory context as opposed to borrowing interpretations from other statutes. Specific to the causation element, the government argued that the court should not import a statutory interpretation of the same language in the Controlled Substances Act to cases involving the anti-kickback statute. And while it remains to be seen what standard the District of Massachusetts court adopts, it's certainly an interesting issue worth watching. But regardless of how the cases continue to play out, the continued focus on the anti-kickback statute violation show that this continues to be an area of high risk from a compliance perspective and one that companies should continue allocating resources towards in terms of monitoring, risk assessment, training, and policies.
I completely agree, Kristen. Thank you. And one last point we wanted to mention is another recent Supreme Court decision affirming DOJ's right to dismiss a QI-TAM case even after DOJ declines to intervene. Could you give us a brief update on that?
Sure. So in the Polanski case, the Supreme Court confirmed that DOJ has the right to dismiss a QI-TAM case even after it declines to intervene. And in recent years, we've seen DOJ move to dismiss a number of QI-TAMs, particularly in the nurse educator space, because it determined that the allegations in those cases conflicted with important policy and enforcement prerogatives of the federal healthcare programs. But the Polanski decision makes clear what standard applies when analyzing whether DOJ's dismissal of a QI-TAM is appropriate and confirms that DOJ has the broad authority to end such cases. While we do not expect to see a significant uptick in cases where DOJ moves to dismiss a previously declined QI-TAM, defendants in such cases still have the opportunity to ask the government to dismiss a meritless case and should consider doing so.
So quite a few interesting False Claims Act cases recently. And from everything we discussed today, I think some of the key takeaways are that companies in highly regulated environments should continue to be sure they understand the relevant rules and regulations, seek guidance and obtain legal advice on unclear issues, and continue to focus compliance program resources on high-risk areas.
I completely agree, Emily. And with that, we want to thank all of you for joining us today. We hope you found this podcast valuable.
The information presented in this recording is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice for a specific situation. If you wish to obtain legal advice, you should retain an attorney and explain the facts of your particular situation.